Good morning, dear saints, and welcome to Thy Strong Word. Today is Thursday, November 28th, and you're listening to the program where each weekday morning we explore the Holy Scriptures to which God bespeaks us righteous and nourishes our faith. I'm your host, Pastor Phil Boo of St. John Lutheran Church in Luverne, Minnesota. Well, our topic today is John, and now we are in chapter 11. We're going to cover the first 44 verses today. When Lazarus falls ill, his sisters send for Jesus, but Jesus delays going. Is it on purpose? What could possibly be more urgent than healing a friend? Well, in this section, we encounter not only grief, but confusion, but also the power and promise of the resurrection. Jesus declares, "I am the resurrection and the life," and he leads us to the tomb, not to mourn, but to witness the glory of God. So join us now as we explore the dramatic moment when death meets its match in the voice of our Savior. Thy Strong Word is underwritten by the Lutheran Heritage Foundation. For those of you who have been under a rock and haven't heard of them, I'm telling you, go check them out. The Lutheran Heritage Foundation does amazing work. They translate and publish and distribute Reformation-focused Christian materials around the world and also just down the road in languages that people can understand, that is, their own language. Not everybody speaks English. Not only your neighbors, but also all kinds of mission fields need materials in the language of the people, and that's part of their mission. So, if you'd like to learn more about how they can help you or all the other great work they do, go online at lhfmissions.org. That's lhfmissions.org. And while you're online checking out the wonderful folks at the Lutheran Heritage Foundation, send me an email too. You know the address, thystrongword@kfuo.org. I'm always welcoming your questions, your comments, your concerns, your corrections, your complaints, your compliments. Hey, if you have something to say, I want to hear it. If you're inspired by today's discussion or something my guest says is just amazing and you want to compliment him for it, do it. Hey, if you disagree with him, do that too. I'll make sure you guys get connected. If you're able to send it while we're on the air, I will absolutely get your question or comment out on the air, but I do have to warn you today, we are pre-recorded. You can also find me on X at Pastor Boo or find me on Facebook. Well, I have a brand new guest, at least to the show this morning. It is the Reverend Dr. Joel Heck. He is the president of Concordia Lutheran Seminary of Lutheran Church Canada. That's located in Edmonton, Alberta. Good morning, Pastor, Pastor President Heck, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here from Western Canada, speaking to people all over North America, I assume.
All over the world. KFUO is broadcast not only in the St. Louis area, but also online at kfuo.org, through podcasts, on-demand, live streaming. It's actually amazing. It's the 100th anniversary of KFUO's radio ministry. And they went from broadcasting a couple of times a week in 1924 to now being kind of pretty much all over the world at the touch of a button. It's amazing what God does through these technologies. In fact, just the fact that you're up in Canada and I'm down here in Minnesota and we're going to be transmitting out of St. Louis is also a testament to the kind of amazing things that God can do. Now, I have to note, a little bit of your pedigree says that you spent some time in Texas and now you're all the way up in Canada. Obviously, the Lord is calling you to some good, important work there, but tell us a little bit about Concordia Lutheran Seminary of Lutheran Church Canada. Now, I know that we're in fellowship with Lutheran Church Canada, but maybe our listeners don't know a whole lot about what goes on way up there in the north.
Yes, so we are a small seminary, one of two seminaries of Lutheran Church Canada. We're located in Western Canada. For those that don't know where Alberta is located, British Columbia on the west coast, just north of Washington and Oregon. I've been here at Concordia Lutheran Seminary for a little over a year, came in the summer of 2023. I had retired a year before that, but then this position became available as an interim position between the previous president, another Minnesotan, Dr. Jim Gimbel, and the next president. So I'm here in a two-year appointment or call to serve as the interim president of Concordia Lutheran Seminary. And it's a pleasure to be here. Got a great staff working well together with the other people on staff as well as the students. And seeking to serve the Lord and the Lucent Church Canada as best I can.
I imagine that it's quite an honor to be selected for that position. Probably, you know, when you retire, you kind of think, well, I'm done for a while. And then, of course, the Lord calls you right back in. But I've heard very good things about you, brother, and I'm so excited to have you on the show. You know, though, we do have a lot to cover, so thank you for that. Why don't we head right into the text? But before we even do that, if you don't mind, please lead us off with a word of prayer, and then we will jump in.
Gracious God, we thank you for your word, which is able to make us wise unto salvation through faith in Jesus Christ. And in John chapter 11, we especially look at Jesus and his power to raise the dead with the assurance that even as he has risen from the dead, so too will we one day. Grant us strength and comfort and direction in our lives as a result of this time together in your word. We pray in your most powerful name, Lord Jesus. Amen.
Amen. Okay, so here we are, John chapter 11, and I'm going to go ahead and read some of the text, but then however you want to present it, I'll just let you just jump right in. So let me read a part of it. Chapter 11, starting with verse 1, here we go. Whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, let's go to Judea again. And the disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you are going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I will go to awaken him. And the disciples said, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he had meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. All right, that's the first 16 verses. So this is an amazing miracle that Jesus is going to perform. We know already the end of the story, but open this up for us.
Yes, a fabulous chapter, one of the great chapters of Scripture that is featured in most people's minds by two things. Number one, especially the raising of Lazarus, one of the three great miracles of resurrection that Jesus performed during his ministry. And the other thing, sort of tongue-in-cheek, I guess you could say, is that this chapter is the location of the shortest verse in the Bible. Verse 35, we haven't gotten to that one yet, but the two words, Jesus wept. So if anybody needs a memorization assignment, they can pick that up, and I think it's probably within their capability. But as you're reading, I was especially struck by the statements in those early verses about the love of Jesus for Lazarus and Mary and Martha in verse 3. The Lord you love is the Lord, the one you love is sick. And then it also says in verse 5, in verse 3, it's the word for brotherly love. But in verse 5, it's the agape love. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And so it's out of this love that Jesus comes and performs this miracle after delaying a couple of days where he is near the Jordan River, across the Jordan River, actually, where John was baptizing, according to the 10th chapter of John.
You know, I actually found that, and I think most people do, very striking, because you're right, and I guess I didn't necessarily pick up on that. I obviously noticed that he says, the one whom you love is ill. The sisters say that, but John says, the one whom you love is ill. That kind of reminds me of the way John even describes himself, you know, the disciple whom Jesus loved. And then, of course, love is mentioned again, as you pointed out, but It's fascinating to me as you read it, and I think probably a lot of people pick up on it. It says because, or it gives this idea that because of the love he had, he doesn't go. it's not what you expect, you know. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer. I think that's kind of interesting that he purposefully, and it's very clear here, he purposely says, you know, I'm not going to go. And of course, he knows all things, so that's striking. And even the disciples pick up on it.
And something else that strikes me about this is in verse 4, the mention of God's glory. He said something similar to that, although without using the word glory, at the beginning of the chapter where Jesus heals the man born blind. But in order to connect the beginning of this chapter with the end, or near the end of the chapter, we look at verse 4, it is for God's glory that this sickness will not end in death. And then you look at verse 40, Jesus says to Martha, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And so even though glory in other contexts is often a reference to the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus, here it's referring to someone else's resurrection, and of course someone whose resurrection was brought about by the one who is the resurrection and the life himself. Quoting from a little bit later in the chapter, verse 25, one of the great I am statements of John's gospel.
You know, and Jesus connecting this glory, when I think of the glory of God, and I don't know that there's any direct connection here aside from just God being involved, but I think of even God getting glory over the gods of Egypt through his power, and then he gets glory over sin, death, and Satan through the crucifixion. Here, it's a foretaste of that glory that God's going to get over enemies. And so I've picked up, oftentimes, the glory of God is over and against the enemies of God and his people. And I wonder if there's a connection there. What do you think?
Yes, well, I think so. That this concept of glory is very, very broad. Even in the 19th Psalm, the heavens declare the glory of God. So there are various applications. God's glory is seen in all of creation because he made everything, but more specifically in people's individual lives, like Mary and Martha, and especially in Lazarus. So he can be glorified even in some of the things that we do day to day as we seek to serve our neighbor, love our neighbor as ourselves.
What do you make of Jesus's comments when they say, well, here's the deal. If he's asleep, Jesus, you talk about him being asleep. If he's asleep, he's going to be fine. Well, he says, he starts talking about how many hours there are in the day. It just seems like almost like a non sequitur. You know, Jesus, you can't go to Judea because they're trying to kill you. You know that. And he starts talking about day and night and light and darkness. I think if I were a disciple in the moment, I would say, no, we're talking about the people trying to kill you, Jesus. Like, what are you talking about? What is he talking about?
Yes, in the 8th verse, they mention that the last time Jesus was in Judah and Jerusalem, they tried to stone him, probably a reference to chapter 10, where Jesus says, I and the Father are one, and they pick up stones to stone Jesus for blasphemy, claiming to be God, which of course we know is actually the case. But Jesus is willing to go where he needs to go in order to accomplish ministry, and he is heading towards Jerusalem because it's not all that long a period of time between the events of this chapter and his crucifixion, as well as his resurrection. In fact, it's at the end of the chapter. I'm sort of jumping ahead to a section we're not looking at today, but
it's
the resurrection of Lazarus, this powerful miracle that causes Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin to decide they need to take steps to have Jesus put to death.
I always think that's an interesting thing, too, because you know, oftentimes I like to try to give the antagonists of the scriptures a little bit of grace isn't the word, but I try to give them a little bit of a break because so many people are unaware. I think of Pontius Pilate and how, in many ways, this guy's just trying to do his job. You know, he's not a believer. We can argue about that one way or the other in terms of what he should or should not know. But you know, so I think of the Pharisees and I think of, well, how would I react if someone came into our assembly and started saying that they were Jesus returned, you know, and this is somehow their experience. But when you have what you just referenced later on, them saying, we have to get rid of this guy because he literally can raise people from the dead and therefore people are following after him, is pretty much an admission that not only do they believe that he very well could be the Christ, but they're not interested in having the Christ be there. That's scary.
Yes, the Sanhedrin, a council of 70 ruling elders, high priests, scribes, Pharisees, very, very powerful body of people in Jerusalem and Judah, but not having the power of capital punishment. So therefore, in order to get this job done, this Jesus put to death, they've got to work through the secular authorities, Pontius Pilate. And they're at wit's end because they realize the power of the miracle, and they realize that some of their own people have seen the resurrection that Jesus performed, and it's becoming extremely difficult for them to offer another perspective because they think Jesus is an imposter, a blasphemer, someone who is going to upset their position and power in Judah, which, of course, they don't like.
This idea of 12 hours in the day, if anyone walks in the day, he doesn't stumble, he sees the light of this world, does that have anything to do with the fact that Jesus's timing here just doesn't seem like it makes any sense? You know, if you love Lazarus, well, then go and take care of him. We know this, of course. Maybe they don't fully understand it, but we know that Jesus knows that he will die, or I think some people say that by the time the news got to Jesus, he may have already died, and yet Jesus still doesn't rush up there. We often want Jesus to rush to our aid in the immediacy of our problems, and sometimes we feel like Jesus is like, well, because I love my servant Phil, I think I'm going to let him suffer a little more. Because I love Mary and Martha, I'm going to let them endure losing their brother. Doesn't sound very, very Jesus-like to our ears. What? How would you understand that?
This is the same Jesus who told his mother, "My time has not yet come." So he says it almost exactly the same thing to the disciples, only in different words. Are there not 12 hours of daylight yet? So we have enough time to get everything done that God the Father wants me to get done. And so Jesus is simply inviting them to have patience. He's in control, even if they don't think he is. He was in control on the Sea of Galilee when they were upset that he was asleep while the storm was blowing on the sea, and they were wondering if they're going to all die. So Jesus is in charge. He's in control. And even Lazarus's life as it ebbs away, Jesus knows what's happening and what's going to happen, and he is setting things up, which is the whole point of sickness not ending in death. I mean, he will die. Even though Jesus says in verse 4 that the sickness will not end in death, because death is not the end of the story. It's not for us. It wasn't for Lazarus, even though Lazarus was one of the very few people who ended up dying twice, both on this occasion and later on at the end of his life. But Jesus marches to a different drummer, to use a cliche. He is following the Father's timetable. He's in touch with his Father. This gospel especially emphasizes this throughout the gospel. And in fact, the term Father appeared 12 times in the previous chapter, in chapter 10, to indicate Jesus' close relationship with his Heavenly Father.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, Jesus, he knows all things. And so I do think here that John is enlightening us with a little bit of the irony, right? So Jesus says it won't end in death. And as you pointed out, it's not going to end in death, and yet it includes death. And for the people who saw Lazarus die or knew that he had died, for them, that's it. It ended in death. I wonder, and I don't know that we're told, but I wonder what the disciples must have thought. I mean, Jesus said, our friend Lazarus, it won't end in death, but then he goes, he died. In the moment, wouldn't you say, wait a minute, Jesus, you literally just said it wouldn't end in death. But then, of course, he does say, but we're still going to go up there and wake him up. I don't know. Had they, and I'm trying to think of just the timeline. So, you know, please enlighten me, Professor. But they haven't seen Jesus raise anybody from the dead at this point, right? Or am I missing maybe a miracle or two?
This is the last of the three miracles, the one that's really close to his death and resurrection. I mean, the passion narratives in John's gospel begin in chapter 13. So the other two instances where, for instance, he raises Jairus' daughter from the dead, I think that happened prior to this, and they would have seen that.
So that adds a little complexity then. That's what I was then curious about. So they've seen him raise people from the dead, or at least understand that he has claimed to have, or people claim that he has. So maybe, I guess, they are starting to get it. I guess what brings me to is Thomas, right? So Thomas the twin Didymus, he says to his fellow disciples, "Well, let us also go that we may die with him." Now, we don't get tone all the time. And the way I read it, of course, can influence how we might understand it. I could say something like, "All right, Jesus is going to raise this guy from the dead. Let's go. If he dies, we'll die with him." Like this sort of victorious kind of confidence. Or it could be sort of like Eeyore, you know, "Well, he won't listen to us and he's going to die. So I guess we'll go. We'll all die together." I don't know. How do you perceive Thomas's response here?
Well, it just reminded him earlier that the Jews tried to stone him the last time that he was in Judah and Jerusalem. And so I think this is Thomas the pessimist. We know him as Thomas the doubter, but he is the pessimist here. He's loyal. Give him credit for that. Mm-hmm. The rest of the disciples are. They're going to follow Jesus even if the way seems to be bleak. And likewise for us, we sometimes need to be reminded that as long as Jesus is going with us, no matter what the future holds, he holds the future and us in his hand. I mean, give Thomas some credit. He's so often put down for being the doubter, but he does respond with "my Lord and my God" when the resurrected Jesus appears to him after the resurrection. For he's going to go with him, even if he thinks that the future is rather dim for Jesus and also for him.
Yeah, I suppose being brave and pessimistic and loyal aren't all mutually exclusive. He could definitely say, "Well, I know this is going to end in disaster, but I'm with you all the way till the end." And I don't know, is that we can't obviously judge him particularly, except when the Bible reveals his unbelief later. But in this case, I don't know that that's even a criticism of his faith. I don't think it's saying he's not faithful. I think one person's pessimist is another person's realist. But maybe. I like how you say he's Thomas the pessimist because, well, frankly, I can kind of identify with Thomas in that way. Sometimes I could be a little pessimistic. Oh, but I tell you what, anything else, though, in these first 16 verses that we've covered so far that maybe you want to make sure people highlight before we head to break? And then when we come back, we'll finish up the next two sections all the way to 44. Anything else that we should make the people aware of?
Yes, perhaps the fact that many Jews believe that the soul stayed in the body for 3 days. And so Jesus, by delaying, that makes the delay 4 days in length so that it's absolutely certain that Lazarus has died. I mean, some of the people that reject the resurrection of Jesus from the dead say that he only swooned on the cross. He didn't really die. And one way of denying the resurrection is by denying also his death. But Jesus is making certain, at least I think, if I can read between the lines, he's making certain that people know that by the time he gets to Bethany, Lazarus is dead by anybody and everybody's definition. And so that makes the miracle that much more obvious, more clear, more powerful for those that witness it.
I think that's absolutely incredibly important, and I'm so glad that you brought it up. You know, oftentimes when I hear this preached a little bit more simplistically, the speculation is that Jesus, it's the same point, I believe. I'm not saying it's not, but people say, you know, Jesus waited this particular amount of time to make sure that he was dead. Same point. But I don't know that I've often heard people talk about that idea that Jesus is this kind of like a contrapuntal. He's expecting certain people to claim otherwise for whatever reason, especially the Jews, which are his adversaries on the ground. And so, yeah, that concept that they could just pass it off by saying, "Well, yeah, he had died, but his soul hadn't left. So, you know, almost anybody could have raised him back to the dead." Of course, it would have been false, but yeah, interesting way to kind of predict the issues that people will have. As you said, it's a little bit of speculation, but I think it's very reasonable. And I think that's helpful. I hope people at home find that helpful too. Well, I tell you what, we are right here at the break. I'm sorry, we are going to have to take it, but I can't wait to get back in the conversation. I'm learning a lot today. Folks, why don't you hang around with me too? When we come back, Pastor Heck will continue opening up for us John chapter 11, and we'll continue through verse 44. We'll see you on the other side.
These are the voices of young Lutherans in Mexico City, children who are excited to learn more about their Savior, Jesus. But they need our help, because good Lutheran books for kids in the Spanish language are in short supply in Mexico. To learn how you can help tell Spanish-speaking kids everywhere about Jesus in a language they can understand, go to the Lutheran Heritage Foundation website at lhfmissions.org/Juan316.
Welcome back to Thy Strong Word. I'm your host, Pastor Phil Boo. With me today, the Reverend Dr. Joel Heck. He's the president of Concordia Lutheran Seminary of Lutheran Church Canada, located in Edmonton, Alberta. Now, before we continue, I just want to remind you folks that if anything's grabbing your attention or leaves you wondering, don't keep that to yourself. Engage us. Send me an email at thystrongword@kfuo.org. You can also drop a message on X at Pastor Boo. You can also find me on Facebook. Now, let's go right back into the text. We have a lot to cover. And I love it. All my guests, I always learn something great from them. But it's also nice to have a guest of, if I may say so, your caliber, brother, because taking furious notes over here. Spoiler alert at home. I also have my guests send me their notes, which always makes me a better pastor. I tell you what. But anyway, let's go into the next section. I think I'll read down through verse 27. All right, here we go, starting with 17. Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming in the world." Now, of course, the story doesn't end there, but we're going to pause for just a second. I'll tell you, the 4 days now stand out to me like a big red flag after our last discussion. Also standing out to me is, and again, we don't have like a record of tone in the Bible. So please correct me if you have a different perspective, but I've always really read into Martha's words here the hurt and frustration. Yes, it's combined with faith in the same way that I mentioned earlier. I think pessimism and loyalty and faith don't necessarily exclude one another. I really do feel Martha's, I just feel Martha going, "Well, Jesus is here. I tell you what, I'm going to meet him at the gate." And I just see her. I have a picture of Martha in my head. You know, she's like a Grandma Schlitzendinger type. Every congregation has one. And there she is. She's just stomping out to there. And with all due respect, she meets Jesus at the gate and says, "Lord, if you'd have been here, Lazarus would still be alive." But then I almost feel like she then backs up and says, "But, you know, I trust you." What do you think?
I think she's pretty much down in the mouth. In fact, I think both of them are, which is why Mary doesn't come and Martha does. Martha's the older sister. She feels the obligation. If anybody's going to greet Jesus, I guess I have to, even though I don't feel like it. And so I think she's really discouraged at verse 21. But then Jesus responds, and in verse 24, she picks up a little bit. And then again in verse 27, after Jesus makes the great "I am the resurrection and the life" statement, she's even more positive, even though the miracle hasn't heard. And it struck me as you were reading that when Martha says, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God," my mind went back to Peter's great confession in Matthew 16, when they're at Caesarea Philippi and Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Almost like she wasn't there, but almost like she had been there and was echoing Peter's confession, which is probably something that others had said on other occasions. But I see her mood beginning to improve between verse 21 and then 24 and then 27. She is on the way up. And of course, the presence of Jesus is the reason for that improved mood.
Yeah, that, I mean, that'll preach, right? The more time she spends with Jesus in the midst of her mourning, even though she's mad at him because of it, the more her disposition improves. I mean, that only preaches, but I think hopefully it speaks to the hearts of our listeners and me too, because, you know, we often get mad at God. And I've heard, like, when I've preached this or taught this and I've said something to the effect of, yeah, I think Martha's pretty hocked off at Jesus. Every now and then, you know, a few people might get their feathers ruffled a little bit, right? No, that's Jesus. You can't, like, be mad at Jesus. And, well, yes, I understand that sentiment. You know, you don't want to just walk around angry at God all the time. But God's our loving Father. Jesus is God incarnate, come and descended to do just what he's getting ready to do, defeat death. And he loves us so much, like just like with your human father, if you had a good relationship with him, you get mad every now and then. And even being angry at God isn't a sign of disbelief, but in many ways, a sign of belief. She doesn't say, you don't care about my brother. She says, I believe in you so much that you can just even raise the dead. If you'd have been here, this wouldn't have happened. And I hear in Martha's voice something I've heard in the voice of people that I've attempted to comfort, you know, being imperfect rather than like Jesus, you know, and I'll point them to the resurrection at the loss of a loved one. And they'll say things like, oh, yeah, I believe that. I believe that, well, yes, heaven and we'll be forever and the new heavens and the new earth. But they're like, I'm hurting now. And I just see that in Martha. You know, yeah, of course, he's going to rise in the resurrection. But I also wanted to point out and support what you just said. Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who's coming in the world. I still don't know that she's completely gets that he's getting ready to raise Lazarus. But as you said, she's coming along. But I wonder, and I hadn't thought about it till you brought it up. I wonder if that is some sort of mantra at this point, to maybe poor use of terms, but a creedal kind of statement that's circling the disciples. I haven't considered that before.
I hadn't before today either. Oh, we're both in the same boat.
Well, we'll race to see who gets published first. How's that?
one of us will be a footnote in the other.
No, I'm just kidding. I really am gonna look into that though, because that is neat.
But anyway, yeah, I think that the take home for me is, you know, it's okay sometimes to get upset with God, because at least you're recognizing that he is indeed in control of the universe. We don't let God off the hook even when things are going bad. Not that you should stay there, of course.
This also reminds me of something that one of the saints of God said to me a long time ago, and that is, he was doing a funeral of a member of the congregation who had died, and one of the family members who had survived asked this man, this pastor, where was God when my loved one died? And the answer, I think he put it in the sermon, actually, the funeral sermon. He said, where was God when so-and-so died? He said, the same place he was when his son was hanging on the cross on Calvary. So it's not an indication of abandonment that someone dies, but it's an indication that he invites us to trust him for the moment, like Martha is beginning to learn to do, as well as for the long term, for eternity, because eventually we'll be able to be reunited with those that have gone before us in death. Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? But he really was not abandoned, even as he hung on the cross, nor were Mary, Martha, and Lazarus abandoned, even though Jesus was several days' journey away. And that's good comfort for us, too, when we're going through dark moments and we think God moved, and the reality is he hasn't moved. He's always there. He's always by our side. He's with us always to the end of the world.
It's very tough, you know, on this side of Christ's return, to put faith, hope, and trust in God and his plan, which is why he doesn't call us to do that by our own volition, right? No one can believe except that we're called. So he does. He strengthens us in word and sacrament and to believe those very things that you just said.
And so I love this idea that Martha, as angry as she is at Jesus, or as I suspect she is at Jesus, as anybody would be, the more time she spends with him, the better her disposition gets. They head back home, of course, where Mary is sort of sulking, perhaps, in private. I don't know, but let me add verses 28 to 37. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. And when the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise and go out quickly, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Lord and the Jews, pardon me, who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and he was greatly troubled. And he said to them, "Where have you laid him?" Well, they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? Could he not have done that?" All right, so that's the end of 37. So lots going on here with Martha coming and sort of, I've always thought of it as sort of being bold. I'm really contemplating, rolling over in my head your comments about perhaps it was also a little bit, or maybe even mostly out of just propriety. She really would have just rather to stay at home too, but she goes because she's the older sister. You're really kind of taking what you said in my brain. Now I really see Mary coming out and almost like, I know these are obviously grown women and very faithful disciples, but you almost see like a kid mimicking her older sister. Not in the sense that she's not sincere, but like she's heard Martha walking around the house for probably 2 days or more, saying that over and over and over, and they both feel that way. So she just comes and she says the same thing to Jesus. "Lord, if you'd have been here, my brother would not have died." And Jesus he's moved by them.
That was undoubtedly part of the conversation between the two women. The verse 21 and 32 are almost identical. First thing out of Martha's mouth, first thing out of Mary's mouth when she meets Jesus. But I see a change in tone at verse 28, the section that you began reading. So she goes and calls Mary. Martha calls Mary because the teacher is here, is asking for you. So this is really not, she's not so down in the mouth like she has been, but she's positive and she wants Mary to be encouraged, even as Martha was. But even though the death of Lazarus is still staring them both in the face, they still have to deal with this reality, but they have no idea what's coming. And that's where you and I get to, and our listeners get to anticipate this, because we've read through the end of the chapter. We know how this story ends. And so we're a little bit easier to convince that everything is going to be all right as we read this meeting with Mary that's a lot like the one with Martha a few moments ago. Earlier.
Now in 32, when she comes and she falls at his feet, she's absolutely worshipful. I definitely hear less of the, I hear more hurt than anger, perhaps, in Mary's voice compared to Martha earlier, who, as you pointed out, has absolutely changed. You know, now it's, you know, the rabbi's here, the teacher's here, he's calling for you, which in a way that would be kind of significant too. I mean, Jesus earlier interacted with women in a way that caused his disciples to be a little consternated, right? What if someone saw you doing that? And I suppose these Jews all hanging around and the close proximity of Bethany to Jerusalem, where they were actively plotting Jesus's death. I think there's a lot of moving pieces here that when we just read the gloss, we miss. We miss the people who are coming up to mourn. We miss, or I should say, we are in danger of missing the people coming up to mourn. Those who might be among them that are basically spies, people who know the relationship Jesus has to this family, and so they're probably lying in wait at the very least. Martha's anger, Mary's hurt, they're both mourning, and Jesus' love for them all. And if we didn't know already that Jesus was planning on raising him from the dead, we base that on his discourse with his own disciples, we might be tempted to believe that he raises Lazarus from the dead kind of like after he feels guilty or something, right? When Jesus saw her wept, he weeps, and he's like, okay, fine, you know, where have you laid him? Let's go do something about it. But that's certainly not the case. So Jesus knew that they would be hurting, and he let them hurt. I think that that's really hard for us to get our mind around.
They felt comfortable enough with him to really let it all out and tell him exactly how they felt. My guess is that they were familiar with the words of the prophet Jeremiah, who in chapter 20 complains to God about, I've been deceived and you've let me down. And Jeremiah just lets it all out. And if they were familiar with the story of Jeremiah, they would know that it would be okay to let Jesus know exactly how they feel, because they love him and they know he loves them. And in a deep, personal, loving relationship, you can share what's on your heart and not be worried about the reaction. But I think one other thing that's going on here is that Jesus wants to make sure that both sisters are there at the tomb when Jesus raises Lazarus. He doesn't want Mary to hear this secondhand. He wants the full impact of the miracle to hit both Mary and Martha in the face. And so he wants her there just as much as he wants Martha.
And
in a certain sense, you and I get to peek over somebody's shoulder and see these things happening as these two women come with Jesus to the place of the tomb.
That speaks again to his timing. You know, had he come earlier when they demanded it, well, they're absolutely right. He could have prevented him from dying, but that's not his plan. And this is where we must trust in his plan. But I didn't mean to suggest earlier, though, that Jesus, I wanted to make it clear that Jesus wasn't raising Lazarus as a backup or a response to his compassion, but I don't want to underestimate Jesus's true compassion. But I understand, frankly, from your notes, that the weeping here of the women and Jesus's weeping, at least from the grammar, might be a little different. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah. There's a different word for weeping that occurs in verse 33 and in verse 35. So Jesus weeping excludes the external manifestation of the sadness, the shedding of tears that's much more quiet. Whereas so often in first century Israel, there were professional mourners who were there for a week after the death, and it was their job to mourn and to wail. And so in verse 33, that word for weeping includes loud expressions of grief, wailing, like one of the translations indicates. He was still deeply moved. I mean, that's very clear from verse 33, like those others who were there at the tomb and with Mary and Martha, but he was under control, and his weeping shows his compassion, shows his love for Mary and Martha, and for Lazarus.
At the top of the show, you joked about how 35 is the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept, right? And and that's true. It's kind of interesting, though, that the shortest verse, at least, you know, the way we reckon it here, it's also the absolute most powerful. I mean, obviously, we have powerful instances of Jesus commending his soul to the Father. You know, Father, why have you forsaken me? A lot of them, of course, at the cross. But maybe second only to the cross, here is the creator of the universe shedding a tear for his creatures. And I don't say that to demean us as creatures, but that is what we are in comparison to God. And so the fact that God cares enough, I think of like my children, or frankly, my wife, or me in some occasions, when you lose a pet, you know, and there's plenty of pets and you always just get another one, but you get really deeply moved. And some people say, well, I mean, I don't know why you're so worried about an animal. And Jesus could easily be accused of that. Like, what do you care about all these sinful people? And yet this does demonstrate just how much he does care. And the Jews say, see how much he loved him. I don't know what the context of that is supposed to be. Are they mocking him? I know the second group is. Or are they commending him? But either way, they're saying something extremely true. Look how much he loved him.
Probably different people within that group. I'm guessing that verse 36 shows one group that was much more appreciative of Jesus. And then verse 37 is the critics. And we know there were plenty of critics that were hanging around Jesus' teachings and his activities who were ready to find some fault with him. And they're even willing to do that after the miracle of the resurrection, amazing that he can do something as powerful as raise Lazarus and still be criticized, still be considered a threat to the position of the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem at this time.
Or worse, even more of a threat because of it. That's the part that always slays me. So we have this idea that Jesus is going to plan from the beginning to raise Lazarus. He knows what's going to happen. It's all working out according to God's timing, not Mary's timing, not Martha's timing, not the disciples, not these Jews. It's all his timing. Some people might erroneously, of course, say, well, it just seems so petty for God to take Lazarus' life just to raise him up to prove a point, and then of course, he's going to have to die again. Now, I've said a little bit tongue-in-cheek, it's not the worst thing that can happen in life is, of course, death. It's the wages of sin, and Jesus gave Lazarus the gift of having to go through it twice. Well, that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but I do hear people sincerely struggle with this idea that God is like a petulant child who's got a magnifying glass on us. But God does not cause people to die. I think that's important for folks to remember.
Well, I have a friend who was near death on one occasion, and ever since that occasion she recovered, she says she's not afraid of dying. She came really close to dying. And so in a certain sense, it's going to be easier for Lazarus the second time than it was the first time. At least if her example is any kind of a guide for us in this situation.
Well, I believe it is, yeah.
Too badly about Lazarus.
No. And that's why I actually say it tongue-in-cheek, because I think the worst part of death for us is not, especially those who are, have faith, is not what comes next. We know where we're going. I just think it's the unknown about the transition, right? We know we'll be with God and we don't know what that is. I'm someone who gets anxious over good things that are going to happen. So I think there's a lot even within Christianity and within our faith that says, I'm afraid of dying and I'm afraid that that's a sign of a weakness of faith. And no. You can be very confident where you're going, but still nervous about the trip there. And I see that. But as you said, in Lazarus's case, man, he's an old pro. Been there, done that, not worried about it at all. And in fact, he gets to spend some more time with his sisters and be just eternally and completely certain of everything that will take place next. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that. But yep, mocking Jesus is nothing new, and it certainly hasn't died down. Yeah, if God's so powerful, then why does he allow bad things to happen? This is the problem of evil. And people in today's modern society think they've just now thought of the problem of evil like we've never considered it.
We sometimes talk about two aspects of God's nature, is immanence and is transcendence, and they're both very, very true. Transcendence, this is the all-powerful God who brought everything into existence, who controls life and death. And then there's the immanence, where he comes close to us. What a friend we have in Jesus. He weeps at the grave of Lazarus. And we see both aspects of God showing up in this chapter, especially, as you pointed out, the compassion that Jesus has, the love that's stated that Jesus had for Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, and even the Jews in verse 36 say, see how he loved him. So the immanence of God, he's not just this distant, powerful God who doesn't know what we're going through, but he is close to us. He can comfort us in our deepest sadness, even at the threshold of the next life, when we contemplate coming close to breathing our last breath before we move on into eternity.
It is comforting knowing that we have a high priest that's not unsympathetic with our weaknesses. Well, we're going to finish up our text now. We're going to work our way through 44. So I'm going to add these final verses and we'll unpack them. This is the climax. Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. And when he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who died came out. His hands and feet were bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. So this is the climax, which unfortunately, just due to the nature of this program, we're literally going to stop with today. So it's kind of a cliffhanger, right? Tune in next time to hear the exciting conclusion. But before we get quite there, we have a few minutes. I don't want to neglect it, but I do want to say one of my favorite verses of the Bible, but only from the King James. It says, Lord, by this time he stinketh. Oh, yeah. So yeah, she doesn't quite get it yet, as we suspected earlier. She's still very confident in the resurrection, but I wonder what she thinks that Jesus wants with the body or the corpse of Lazarus. Like, wonder what's going through her mind. She's like, Lord, that's going to be nasty. Don't do that.
I think she's totally puzzled. She wants to protest, but she doesn't want to tell. No, we can't do that. She's going to have it done, have the stone moved away, but she thinks that Jesus is going to end up being embarrassed. And if Jesus is, so also are he and my. One of the things that Jesus says in verse 40 or 41 is something that we could echo too. And that is, Jesus says, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. And sometimes when we think about praying, we think God already knows what we want, what we need, what we're going to say before we say it. And so what's the point of praying? And I suppose Jesus could have just mentally issued the command for Lazarus to come out, but nevertheless, he does it. In this instance, he says, especially for the benefit of those people who are there, that they might also believe. But sometimes just voicing the prayer request when we pray it, so we know that God knows what we're thinking before we even think it, it's more important for us to say it, even though God already knows what we're going to say before we say it.
That's really helpful, actually, because, you know, prayer is one of those things that I continue to struggle with, in the sense of just what you said. You know, we're having to reconcile this idea that God knows all things. He's pleased to give us what we need without our even asking, as we might quote Luther. At the same time, he commands us to pray. So do we pray merely because he just commands it and we're supposed to? Well, yeah, but there are also benefits to it. Frequently, I point to the idea that even in our act of prayer, we're reminding ourselves who it is that does provide for us, kind of like the way that Martha goes out to meet Jesus, and even though she may have one intention based on her hurt, she ends up in the presence of Jesus becoming more calm and more assured. So when we spend time with Jesus in prayer and we hear his response to our prayers by reading his word, then yeah, we're spending time in conversation with our Father and through Jesus, and all of this is going to build up our faith. But I really like what you point out here, because I think of a couple ironic instances within the church where, for instance, like on Ash Wednesday, when the reading is about don't disfigure your faces and wash your head. And we're all sitting around listening to this with ashes on our faces. And we're like, okay, you know, are we doing the right thing? Or those Sundays when the lectionary comes around and it says they think that they will be heard for their many prayers, and they walk around with all these fancy garments, and I'm up there head to toe in tassels and golden garments and saying these long prayers of the church. And you just think, wait a minute, are we the bad guys? You know, but the idea here, and I'm getting to the point, I really do promise, but you just said something that really has struck with me, and that is, he prays out loud, first of all. You know, it's not like, well, he could just secretly do it. Of course he could. I mean, he could have done it from where he was standing, but he comes there, he interacts, he is an incarnate God. He thanks the Father. Wait a minute, I thought Jesus was God, so why does he have to talk to his Father? Well, if you don't understand anything else, understand this, that other people's benefit is on the line. He wants them to hear what he's saying. And same for us. Anyway, I just, sorry to go on a little tangent, but I was very moved by what you said. That's interesting.
But verse 42 also reminds me of near the conclusion of John's gospel, when John talks about the reason why this gospel was written. Jesus says that they may believe that you sent me. And John says a lot more could have been written, but these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John himself, towards the end of the gospel, is echoing the words of Jesus here in the 11th chapter of the raising of Lazarus. There's one other thing I wanted to note that struck me as I was preparing for this today, and yeah, that is the last sentence of verse 44, the section that we are closing with. Jesus does something similar to what he did at the raising of Jairus' daughter, because after Jairus' daughter comes back to life, Jesus asks them to give something to her to eat. He's thoughtful. He's not all caught up in his own power and his own glory, but he's thoughtful enough to realize that that little girl is probably hungry. And here Jesus wouldn't have had to say what he said, because that probably would have happened without him saying the words, but he is specifically telling them to take the grave clothes off him. Maybe they're struck, maybe they're dumbfounded at what just happened. They can't believe their eyes, and they need to be moved to action and be reminded that he is in fact alive. So take the next obvious step. And so they sort of wake up from their reverie, and they actually do what he tells them to do. So Jesus is thoughtful even after the powerful miracle has already occurred.
You're absolutely right. And yet another element that I don't know that I've really pondered. You know, I have often thought about how, well, you know, they have to be told and how they're very likely dumbfounded. But as you were describing it, I was just picturing Lazarus. And I don't know if they had something on his face either, but I just picture Lazarus kind of, first of all, I can't even imagine what he's thinking. I don't even want to speculate. But it's like, you guys going to go help him or what? People don't even know what to do. Unbind him. Let him go. But you know what would also preach? That unbinding, right? He unbinds us from the consequences of death, Jesus does. He lets us go. I think there's a lot here.
Yeah. I can almost imagine Lazarus, if he's able to raise his hand, just raising his hand and say, hey, people, I mean, I'm still here. I need a little bit of help getting out of these grave clothes. Excuse me, come on over here, please.
Like, hello?
I'm alive. Yeah.
Well, and what's really sad, too, is that then, of course, the Jews believe so much in these miracles, they want to kill Jesus. Now, of course, not all of them, but the Jewish authorities for sure. And then today, people usually just dismiss it as old wives' tales or just something that's made up by Christians for whatever reason they can imagine. But I think another fascinating part of it is that, you know, we have Jesus. He calls Lazarus out. Lazarus is alive. You already mentioned the 4 days, preemptively, perhaps trying to make sure that no one can question it. But today we do have situations, very rarely, of course, where someone will either have a heart rate so low that people think they're dead, they're declared dead, and they return to life, air quotes, or they literally get buried and they end up being alive. There was a story where a young girl went to the hospital in a different foreign country, and you guys can Google it. It's pretty famous, and it is a verified story, although there is some misinformation about it floating around. But the very basics of the truthful part is that she went and they declared her deceased, and they prepared for a funeral, and she literally woke up in the middle of the funeral. The sad thing about it is that she was very ill, and she did end up passing away again very, very shortly after it. But the point is, people look at this and say, well, even if this happened, it was just one of those situations. You know, Jesus, but even if that were the case, I mean, it's not, absolutely not. Jesus would have had no way of knowing or setting that up. I mean, that shows the irrationality of trying to just explain away these amazing miracles. I would rather someone just say, I don't believe that ever happened, than to say, it's some big conspiracy by, no. We only understand these things in faith, and it's not blind faith, but this man who had died came out. And I think another thing that John's telling us by describing us in this almost comical kind of way, you picture almost like a mummy or something, but no one is going to wrap his hands and feet with linen strips and bind his face with a cloth unless they know he's dead. And so while we do have these rare occasions, It just doesn't fit here. And I say that for those people who may have heard those arguments.
Yeah, the detail of these last couple of verses especially remind us that this actually happened. This is a historical event. Aspect to these details that if John was making this up, he just wouldn't have included the detail about the strips of linen, separate cloth around his face, which does coincide with what John tells us later on about Jesus' own burial cloth. There was a separate cloth for the head than the cloth for the body. So some realistic details, as well as that last statement of Jesus, just only makes sense if this really happened in history, and maybe one of the reasons why John records it in the way that he does.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, you know, so many people are, and not people of faith, but so many people who are hostile to faith, they want to dismiss these things as impossible or outside their own experience, and perhaps it is outside their own experience. But as you already told us, John gives us these things so that we might believe. And the good news is, it's not about convincing you or yourself or anyone else that these things are true, but it is all about the Word working in you and giving you faith. Well, I'm sorry, brother, but we're going to have to bring our session to an end. And boy, I could just keep talking with you all day long, but I'd like to thank my guest this morning, the Reverend Dr. Joel Heck. He's the president of Concordia Lutheran Seminary of Lutheran Church Canada in Edmonton, Alberta, one of our wonderful fellowship partners up in the Great North. Thank you, brother, for being on the show.
A pleasure and a privilege. Thank you for having me.
Folks, tomorrow we are going to keep on going. We're going to finish out our week by finishing out John chapter 11, so don't miss that. But until then, may God's peace and blessings be with you all as we pray, Father, keep us in thy strong word.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.